Good afternoon and welcome to our Independence Day episode of And Then There's That, a bi-weekly podcast of people, politics, and punditry in Howard County on the HOCO Mojo Network. I'm Paul Scalney, and I'm here at the Mall in Columbia with my co-host, Dennis Lane. Joining us today is Andrea Ingram, the Executive Director of Grassroots Crisis Intervention Center. But as always, we first like to take a look at some of the news making the headlines this week. Dennis, what you got?
We're going to head off with the schools. Big news in the public schools arena this week. The MSA assessments came out. That was in the Sun papers. Big news. And once again, in our lovely county, as Sarah Toth wrote in Explore Howard, Howard County students are scoring at a higher level than their counterparts in other districts, according to the latest Maryland State assessments. You know, I hate to say it, it's almost like a non-news story now. I mean, Howard County schools consistently are beating the other counties in these standardized tests that I guess measure achievement. But there was this year, there was a particularly bright spot is that the, 93% of eighth graders scored at the advanced or proficient levels in reading, the highest ever for the county. So even within their high levels that they're used to, they had even higher level than normal.
You know what was interesting to me about the story, and I did hear it on the news, on WBAL, they talked about a lot of jurisdictions having an increase in test scores, and obviously Howard County has done very well. And this article that you, however, reference, what was not in this article is what I think is just as interesting as what was in the article, which is the Baltimore City schools have dropped.
Yeah.
Significantly.
And then the news I read this morning is that they've just renewed Alonzo's contract.
And scores dropped, but there's still evidence of cheating at least three schools.
Yeah.
And now several others are under investigation. So you can imagine how well they would have done if they hadn't cheated.
You know, the thing about this that I like to point out is that if you listen to some people, they'll say, you know, that particularly those who kind of support some of the more nonconformist members of our school board, that these schools are far from, you know, from good. We have a lot of problems in our school system. You know what? Howard County has got a good school system. It's a very important part of our economic development. And I think both the teachers, administrators, staffs should be applauded for these great results again.
Absolutely. I think they do a great job. And I know I'm going to get off on a tangent here a little bit. Yes, Howard County schools, I think, are phenomenal schools and do a great job given the posture of our education system today. You know, and we can get on this old tangent about teaching to tests. And we've talked about this before, so we'll skip that.
Maybe another show.
Maybe another
day. You know, which, of course, I'm going to kind of jump off topic here a little bit. But we have a school board. We have a school show coming up, actually a couple. Can I talk about that? Can I talk about what we're trying to do?
Sure, absolutely.
You know, school board member Alan Dyer has been in the news, and we have reached out to him. We'd like to have him on the podcast, kind of give him a chance to, you know, tell things as he sees it. But to balance that as well is we've invited another school board member to come on too, and it's a separate show to kind of, you know, do a kind of point counterpart. We'll have on together because we're not like this confrontational stuff, but. You know, during the summertime when, you know, the schools are out, good time to think about where we're going and the things that are facing our school system. So, you know, all these are timely. But, you know, we didn't. And speak well about the schools.
So going back to the scores, you know, despite the increase in scores.
Despite the increase in scores.
Howard County schools were not on the Newsweek magazine released earlier this week of the annual poll of the best public high schools in the country.
And I got to tell you, when I saw that release, when it came across, you know, the internet on my news feed, I said, Newsweek rankings. I said, wonder which Howard County schools got it this year. Because last year, there was like a handful of Howard County
schools. Centennial got it, River Hill got it. Several schools have actually had it over the years.
Right. And so I'm looking through the list. There wasn't any Howard County schools on it. I was like, well, what happened? In a period of a year, we dropped that bad?
You read on in the story, and this is, you know, you and I debated this a little bit over lunch, and it's not completely clear as to what the reasoning is, but according to Patty Kaplan, the Howard County Public School Systems Director of Public Relations, the reason none of the Howard County schools are on the list is because they didn't submit the information necessary for Newsweek to evaluate them.
We elected not to participate because we needed some clarification on the formula that they're now using. The timing on it was rushed as well.
So, you know, Dennis, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but Dennis seems to think that, you know what, it was a new process and they required new things and it required a lot of school system resources to pull all the information together. You know, to me, that just doesn't ring true. Can you imagine the conversation between Patty Kaplan and Ken Allman? God, Ken, I'm really sorry. We just don't have time to pull the information together to get us on another list.
That he loves to talk about.
Right. So I don't know.
I can't imagine that conversation went well. But there was light at the end of the story. Actually, there was a note that several Howard County schools made the Washington Post annual list of the best high schools in the country. River Hill, Centennial, Mount Hebron, Marriott's Ridge, Howard, Glenel, Athelton, Wild Lake, and Long Reach were all named among the best high schools in the country for the 2011 poll. Did I miss any? Isn't that all of them?
I was going to say, that's the Washington Post top nine high schools in Howard County.
And, you know, we joke on this show about Howard County being the... being a tough place for a private school. You know, we had Carol from Glenel Country School on. You know, and we said, well, who goes to Glenel Country School? And the joke is what? Parents who think the best schools in the country aren't good enough for their kids?
Right. And her position was people that are looking for a community, right. One place to go to school for all 12 years. You build, you know, kind of a familial relationship with all the other folks that you go to school with. But
the bottom line, it's tough for a private school to exist in Howard County. This year, Woodmont Academy in Glenwood announced...
couldn't get enrollment to where they needed it to break even.
Yeah, it's a shame. In recent years, they've added new buildings out there and have put a lot of money in that school. And then this week, we hear that the Norbell School, which took over the old Elkridge Elementary School or Middle School, whatever it was down in Elkridge. It's a 50s-era building, but they bought it from the school board a couple of years ago, did some renovation
and
on
now
it.
And now we're looking to build new schools in Elkridge, right?
Well, you know.
I'm just saying.
That's always an easy thing to do. This building was built in the 1950s. It fit for Norbell's use. It really doesn't fit kind of the modern school formula. You're rolling your eyes and you're looking at me.
No, okay. I wouldn't do that.
Yes, you are. You were rolling. People are listening to the podcast can't see. His eyes are rolling like two BBs on a, I don't know.
All right, so how about Alex Ketley from Wild Lake?
Alex.
He's a graduate.
I heard he's a good dancer.
He's a great dancer, and he's gonna have his debut on So You Think You Can Dance this week.
Wow.
It's pretty cool.
Did you ever watch that show?
I have watched that show. No. My kids watch the show.
No.
I want to spend quality time with my children, so I hang out and watch the show.
I watch football. Paul watches dance shows. I think that just speaks for itself.
That's just because I'm man enough to admit that I can watch football and dance shows.
Okay.
You'll get there one day, Dennis.
Yeah, I will. But, you know, and then other news in Wild Lake this week, some people in Wild Lake are very upset that some trees have been being scorched earth policy on behalf of BGE on the gas line right away. Listen, the public utilities have every right to make sure that there's clearance around these gas lines and power lines. It never fails to happen. You know, usually about this time of year, people who also live along the high, the big power lines too, get mad when BGE comes and trims the trees back along the edges. And I guess they did it in a path from Clarksville to Elkridge.
This strikes me as such Howard County hypocrisy at its finest. You know what? These are the very same people that if there was a gas leak and the gas and electric company couldn't get to fix the pipeline quick enough, they'd be complaining that they couldn't get there quick enough. Or if it was, there was a fire and they couldn't get there to put out the fire, they'd be complaining that why were there trees and wouldn't it have been easier to bring fire engines in if the trees hadn't been there? Come on.
No, you know, and they forget that right-of-way is probably paid, you know, they pay property taxes on right-of-way in addition to...
But utilities have easements, across those places.
Absolutely. And God forbid their natural gas would go out because it was a problem.
You know what? The folks in Wild Lake are very lucky because Liz Bobo has come to their rescue.
Oh, my God. I didn't know she was an expert in gas line safety.
I don't know why you didn't know that.
Well, I didn't, but, you know, the abilities of Delegate Liz Bobo never cease to amaze me.
And then
because,
there's that.
Because, as she said, she's concerned that the clearings seem to be more than the 20-foot-wide berth. She says, safety is paramount. I know that, she said. It just looks to me like more is being done than necessary. I'm sure they're doing more than necessary. Yeah, they want to spend more money than they have to.
Just to cut down trees.
Just to cut down trees, but anyway.
So, County Councilwoman Courtney Watson, as many of you know from reading the newspapers and hearing the story out and about, and also from our show last time, introduced a piece of legislation that was going to help Ellicott City swimming pools. And Courtney Watson is actually going to be joining us.
Private swim clubs.
She'll actually be joining us at the end of the show today to talk a little bit about this. But we wanted to mention that the story has really taken sort of a life of its own.
Well, yeah. What happens is that apparently a couple of years ago, the state of Maryland passed legislation, I believe at the behest of Montgomery County, to allow counties to grant a property tax exemption to private swim clubs.
Who would have thought you're an expert on pools? You and Liz really have something in common there.
I think I'm in the deep end here. But I'm going to dive right in. I can't help myself sometimes. I'm only getting part of the story straight. But what happens is when they try to do this thing for these Howard County swim clubs that are having a bit of financial difficulties not because of property taxes, because they've got aging infrastructure, and they're all facing major bills.
That they didn't plan for. They didn't put money aside for.
They didn't plan for their retirement. Apparently not.
Just so we're clear.
So that may have worked in Montgomery County, which doesn't have a giant Columbia Association sitting smack dab in the middle of its county that also has 23 private pools and that would not be eligible by some readings of this law for this exemption. So it didn't take long for them to cry, foul, wait a minute. If you're going to grant property tax exemptions to these seven or eight private swim clubs, you got to include the Columbia Association.
And that's because the original legislation provided that a nonprofit entity organized exclusively as a swim club would be eligible for the exemption.
Yeah, but a lot of these private swim clubs have tennis courts.
And that's where I'm confused.
Yeah, right. What do you do about that? It's working its way through. Again, the larger issue, and this property tax benefit will not really help them get over that hurdle of these big infrastructure
costs. It's a
Band-Aid. It's a financial Band-Aid. The real problem is how are they going to handle these major improvements in the coming years? And dues alone are not going to cut it. There was a funny thing. We talked about this at lunch. And one of the spokespeople for one of the private swim clubs in Ellicott City is a guy named Greg Dale. I don't know Greg, but I knew his dad. His dad, George Dale, worked with the Rouse Company when I did. And it struck me that a lot of people in Howard County, in order to kind of establish their bona fides when they're speaking or representing themselves, like to make that relationship somehow to the Rouse Company. And as he put in a comment on my blog introducing himself, he says, as a resident of Howard County for over 40 years and the son of a Rouse Company executive for 30 of those years,
somehow that legitimizes his right to speak on your blog. I don't know.
Does that mean like he kind of knew somebody who knew Jim Rouse who may have, I don't know.
I'm impressed.
Yeah, but it's funny. I think that's something unique to Howard County.
Friendly Inn.
Yeah, there's another kind of Howard County institution, older, going back to the early days. Friendly Inn is a roadhouse bar. I mean, there's no other way to describe it.
It's a dive.
It was. It's closed. The Friendly Inn closed.
It's a friendly dive, but it was a dive.
It was a dive. It closed back in earlier in the spring. Friendly Inn is a roadhouse. It's an Ellicott City on Old Frederick Road, kind of West Ellicott City, I guess. I heard at a function at your new building down in Elkridge, I heard that the Iron Bridge boys, the Wecker brothers, were going to be involved in kind of getting that place open again and rehabbed. And I know Rob and Steve Wecker, they're great guys. Shame on me, I didn't call them to verify it, because the guy I was talking to was a guy I kind of thought, he kind of knows that. He lives out there, he's in commercial real estate. I'm not going to say his name, but boy, he had that one wrong, because Rob called me, or actually sent me an email saying, that's not true, they're not involved. But they should be. This is right up their alley. It's got the same issues facing it that the Iron Bridge did. The Iron Bridge was a former roadhouse. You can't just tear that building down and build a new bar in that place there. You probably would never get the same kind of
You run into permitting issues and site development problems
the
and
building
things like that.
As exists, the building's closer to the road than you would be allowed under current regulations. The parking lot needs to be redone to handle stormwater management. I mean, there's a lot of issues that it's going to be expensive to do what he wants to do to reopen that place up.
I appreciate that the place has nostalgic value to a lot of people in this community, but it strikes me again, we went through it in Columbia, leave Columbia alone. This is what Jim Rouse wanted. They don't want change, and I know people resist change all the time, but there are people that are out there that are saying this is a landmark. It's been here for a long time. One lady went as far as calling it cozy, suggesting that we need to keep it. You know what? For those of you that have
cozy's
been there.
Cozy is another word for rundown.
Very politically correct.
And speaking of rundown,
Larry Carson.
Larry Carson.
Oh, you bloggers just ran him into the ground.
I got a hand to Larry. In his last months, he actually finally got friendly to the blogs. You know, when we first kind of started blogging more and more about local issues, Larry would say, I never read the blogs. Come on, Larry, we know you'll read them. And he finally kind of admitted to it at the end. But you know, the fact of the matter remains, Larry, how long was he on the beat here in Howard County?
I want to say it was in 1969, I think he started working
69.
From his home office in Columbia.
You think of all the news he's covered in this town, you know, over the period of his career. And it's been a very storied career, I think.
Actually, it was at the Wild Lake Village Center, excuse me, at his first office.
And one of the things that scares me is that, you know, the Sun had a dedicated beat reporter to Howard County, you know, a full-blown staff member that covered Howard County. I don't think they'll do that again. I think they're going to look to Patuxent Publishing to kind of fill in the Howard County stories into the paper and online. And there's a difference here. The Sun staff reporters are union, and the Patuxent Publishing are non-union. And so rather than probably bring up one of those great writers that they've kind of... I always saw the Patuxent Publishing maybe as sort of a farm team for the major paper. But it doesn't look like they're going to treat it that way. They're going to try to probably cover Howard County on the cheap.
So without making your head bigger and, you know, the head of
God
other
knows,
bloggers out there bigger, is this an opportunity for the bloggers to maybe fill even more so a role in reporting on local stories previously existed?
I don't think so. The bloggers, a web blog by definition is a personal web blog. It's a journal, you know, and we rely on the journalist to write the stories. We cover some things ourselves and put it out there. But the major news, you'll see that both Tom Cole, Trevor Green, Sarah Hussein, all the regular bloggers out there, they'll quote and link to the stories written by paid reporters.
And we do the same thing on this show.
Yeah, we're right. You give them the deference that they do for doing the hard work of reporting. And, we need them. The community needs good coverage in journalism. And I'm just afraid that if they don't establish another beat reporter for Howard County through the Sun and they just rely on Patuxent Publishing, then we'll have gone backwards a little bit on that. So, good luck, Larry. Enjoy your retirement. We might have him on the show.
That'd be great.
I would hope he could be a lot more candid now and... I don't know. We'll invite him. Put it out there. Without any further ado, joining us today is Andre Ingram, the executive director of the Grassroots Crisis Center in Columbia, in Howard County. Actually, yeah, you're in Columbia. It's over there off of
Freetown Road.
Right next to Athelton High School.
And that's a new facility, right?
We've been in our facility now for 3 years, exactly.
Well, you've been with the organization long enough. 22 years, I believe.
That's right.
And I actually remember when Grassroots started. It was behind the Banneker Road Firehouse in Town Center.
Mm-hmm.
Were you a recipient of its services, or
what's that?
Were you a recipient of their services at the time?
You know, Grassroots was funny. When it started, it was a very kind of a hippie kind of a place.
This is true.
The kids were great. Yeah, just drop in, man.
Huh.
You know? Okay, cool. You know, and there was music playing, posters on the wall. It was kind of a cool place for that. It has certainly evolved into be much more. Can you kind of give us the cook's tour of what it is today?
Sure. I would add that I think in the early days it was even a little controversial.
I'd say a little.
A little controversial. And
because a kid could get what was known as a kid could go in there with pregnancy or drug issues and be frank, and you would not tell parents or anything. They could have an honest discussion, you know, and it would be kept quiet.
And it was all volunteers,
yes.
So you didn't have professional training. So it was more peer support and peer counseling.
Right.
And so each executive director, when I looked back at the history, each executive director went to further try to professionalize the organization. And in fact, when I came 22 years ago, that's also what I did.
Mm.
So now, there are really two main parts of our mission. And I think people are mostly familiar with the shelter programs now. They seem to get more attention. But our original mission, being a crisis center, is still a good solid half of what we do. So we still answer quite a few hotlines, 24-hour hotlines, crisis hotline. We participate in a national suicide prevention hotline. We answer hotlines for other organizations 24 hours. So it's
is
really
that right? Is that under contract?
Yes, by contract. So, for example, we answer the domestic violence hotline, and we answer. We do after-hours backup for organizations like Humanum and Waystation. So,
you know, it's funny you mentioned domestic violence. We actually talked about this at lunch. One of the challenges that an organization like yours has is board leadership.
And, absolutely.
And domestic violence was big in the news this year with having a problem with that. How do you assure that your board stays, I don't know, Paul, what's the word I'm looking for here?
Well, I think every nonprofit organization needs to have, you know, good succession at their board. They need to have the right people. They need to have engaged board members. I think there needs to be accountability with regard to accounting and the finances, particularly organizations like yours and domestic violence that's a beneficiary of public funds. What do you do within your organization to ensure that organizations don't turn for the South and actually end up growing and prospering and having the right people on board doing the right things for the organization? What's the magic there?
Well, I don't know if there's magic, but I can tell you what I do. I think, first of all, I really respect and appreciate my board and look to them.
Who's ahead of your board right now?
Jeff Kasman. He's the president and owner of Cascon Corporation.
Cascon, sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he's fantastic. He's really wonderful. So I learned early on, since I came from a county government position in Montgomery County, came to a nonprofit, totally different experience, and learned to really use my board of directors, because an executive director can't know everything. So I use the expertise of my board members. And the other half of that is not just how the executive director sees the board, but how the board embraces itself and takes its own responsibility very seriously. And they really need to do that. I mean, they have authority, they have responsibility, they have oversight responsibility. I report to the board. They supervise me. We have...
Do you need a lot of supervision?
I like a lot of supervision. I like a lot of supervision.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well,
so
you knocked that
for
one
example,
back.
We have a business operations committee that we report to every single month on our finances. For me, that's like a pop quiz every month. We want to make sure that we can answer every question that the board has about spending, about what's come in, about grants, and following, you know, following how the funds are going in and out.
What
and
kind of budget does
responsible.
Grassroots have?
Our budget this year is about $2.6 million.
Wow.
So it's a lot to keep track of.
And where does the lion's share come from, the county? Or?
About half. About half of
and
our funding comes
donations?
From the county. No, we have state funding.
Oh,
we have
sure.
some federal funding, mm-hmm. United Way, foundations, contributions, and then some smaller foundations. So it's really very diverse. And one of the things that gets more difficult all the time is that the more funding sources you have, the more reporting you have to do, administrative requirements
sure.
go
sure.
up. And I would say in the last few years, that's been one of the challenges for organizations, is that the monitoring requirements have really, every year, become more and more stringent. There's more and more reporting. So at the same time that we're trying to keep our administrative costs down, we're being asked to do much more to report administratively so that we can show how well we are using funds and that we're using them the way they were designated to be used. So I can't underestimate the role of the board and the responsibility of the board, but it's really a two-way street. I have to be completely open and thorough in what I report to the board, and then they have to be willing, you know, to take me on if they don't agree with something. So it's really a very strong two-way street.
Well, I mean, your 22 years of tenure speaks to a little bit of stability between the board and the executive leadership, too. So
thank you for explaining that, because I think it's been an interesting issue with DVC and Domestic Violence Center of what they've gone through. But let's go back to sort of what you do
what
as an organization.
Do.
Let's make sure we get that out.
So yesterday, being the last day of our fiscal year, I sort of have some interesting numbers in my head.
Great.
The crisis services, I said, you know, we answer a lot of crisis hotlines, and we'll have close to 40,000 crisis calls this year. So this is,
wow.
they're going up quite a bit every year. In the last 2 or 3 years, the people who are calling us with issues about financial stresses, that has gone up about 30% every year. So even Howard County, talk about how, you know, Howard County is so, you know, we're well off compared to so many other places. There are many, many people who've been affected in a hard way
sure.
by the economy, and we see that in our crisis calls and our walk-ins. We also have the mobile crisis team. which is two master's level folks, which is a partnership with Humana. We go out with the police on psychiatric emergencies, on family crisis, and on traumatic death situations in the county. Last year, we had about 320 cases.
All in Howard County?
All in Howard County.
Wow.
And this year, we have 430 cases. So there's been a huge increase in the number of outreach situations we're doing with the police department. And these are all very serious situations.
Well, if I'm involved in a negotiation in my office and people start getting crazy, can I call you guys in?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
<all the>
We've been, you know, and businesses have used us.
Is that right?
I'll give you a couple of examples. There have been, this year, there were a couple of businesses that suffered the suicide of one of their employees. And they had the wherewithal to call for the mobile crisis team, call for grassroots. And we have gone out and worked with employees as a group after they have suffered a tragedy like this in their among their peers.
Now, is that a public service? Is that a service that you provide to businesses alike?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Interesting.
So we have all of our crisis services, and that's really all increased this year. And then we have our shelter programs, which I think people are more familiar with. And in our new building, which is 3 years old, we have right on those premises an 18-bed men's shelter and a 33-bed family and children's shelter. And we also have sort of an emergency overnight kind of program.
I'm glad you brought that up because most people think of shelters in the wintertime. Are all those beds taken at the shelter right now?
Yes, they are.
Wow.
And then in addition to that, we have up to five families that are in motel shelter for a very short term. I can only keep them in motel for 2 weeks, so we're really working pretty intensively. One counselor who works with those families very intensively to try to come up with a satisfactory resolution when their 15 days in motel shelter is over.
Yeah, well, I mean, what happens at the end if you haven't found one? They go back on the street?
Well, we kind of push people to think about alternatives that they might not have been willing to consider. A little reality testing. Yeah. Are there any friends? Is there any family? We have helped people reunite with family in other locations.
Paul's house.
Nice.
And then when we have an opening in the shelter, we look at who's in motel, and we tend to bring in the most vulnerable people who really don't have any options.
Now, I know Howard County General Hospital is one of the few hospitals in this area that has an inpatient psych unit.
Correct.
Do you work closely with Howard County General with individuals that maybe call in and are suicidal or are having other psychological issues?
I wouldn't say that there's really a close working relationship there. We do have some after-hours telephone support that we give to a couple of hospital programs. Most of the time when we're dealing with someone who's having a psychiatric emergency and we have to help them get to the hospital one way or another, either voluntarily or involuntarily, we would be going in usually with the police through the emergency room. And so our folks would be in the same process that anyone would be who goes to the emergency room, with perhaps a little bit higher level of priority, because we're going in with the police and our counselors will present information to the hospital staff so that they have a more complete picture about what is the reason that the person is here, what is this crisis about. And so we might have a little better chance of having that person get hospitalized
if
that's what they need. Right, exactly.
Now, are the services that you provide largely provided by paid staff or contractors, or do you also rely on volunteers?
Well, it's interesting. Our core services, we have a paid staff. We have about 80 paid staff at
this
time.
Wow.
But then there are some programs that we do that are
Full and part-time.
Full and part-time.
How many full-time?
About 26 are full-time.
Wow.
A lot of part-time people. Because, you know, when you're open 24 hours a day, you got weekends. We have a lot of part-time weekend staff.
24 hours in a row?
All the time. Yes, sir.
Just checking.
I think it's important in answering your question to talk about our partnerships with the faith community. The Cold Weather Shelter is another program that has a very minimum number of staff and hundreds of volunteers.
Right, churches and stuff.
Exactly. So this goes from right around Thanksgiving until the end of March. And there are 14, 15, 16 congregations that participate in that, and they host it for 1 week. We will have one or two staff people there while it's open, the congregation will use up to and even more than 100 volunteers each week to keep the program running. So it's very intensive for the congregation. It's a wonderful partnership, and we couldn't do it without them. The other great partnership is the Route 1 Day Resource Center, which some listeners, I hope, may have heard of or even being participating in. That is another partnership with the faith community. It's open 3 days a week, serving people who are actually living outside along the Route 1 corridor. That opened 3 years ago, and we've served over 550 people in that program since it opened. And congregations take responsibility for 1 day, and they would provide the meal and serving and additional volunteers to help deal with the pantry and the clothes closet and transportation. So that's another program. So, you know, we're really a mix of doing things with professional staff and then relying so much, especially on the faith community, to help us with these other programs.
We are we're kind of getting to the end of our time here, but I wanted to ask you, it's a big weekend coming up in Howard County. It's the 4th of July weekend. Is this a big weekend also for the Crisis Center? Will you see a lot of calls?
In my experience, July 4th weekend is a big weekend for Crisis. You know, there's a lot of celebrating. There's a lot of drinking. Yeah. That leads to a lot of conflict sometimes, or people taking risks that they normally wouldn't take. Then you have other people who feel left out of the celebration. That's a different crisis for them.
Right.
So I think holiday times in general are a tough time for all of those reasons.
So you'll be staffed up for that?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Great.
I did want to hit on one more thing before we let you run. From a donating perspective, whether it's food, whether it's time, whether it's dollars, what are ways that people can contribute? I know I often attend an event. And there's leftover food, and people say, oh, we should take it to grassroots. Is that something that can be done at any time?
We love that. We cannot get too much food. It is really not possible.
Wow.
Although, I have to take that back a little bit. Sometimes someone do a huge drive for us, and we'll get more than we can store or manage, and then we'll share it with other organizations. We'll take it to the food bank. We do that a lot. So it's actually a good place to bring things, because if we can't use it, we'll make sure somebody else
comes. You know how to redistribute it.
Because we're open on weekends and nights when other folks aren't open, so we can make sure that it gets to the right place. Financial contributions are always welcome. We have different volunteer activities for young people. A lot of volunteers these days like to do one-time projects. We just had a group from Bethany United Methodist Church that did some wonderful gardening for us. And so, you know, we're always, you know, wanting to work with groups that have some special expertise and see how we can work together.
And if someone wants to volunteer, how can they reach you?
They can call either our 24-hour number or our regular number. And do you want me to say those?
Yes,
numbers?
Please.
Our 24-hour crisis number is 410-531-6677. That's 24 hours. And our business number is 410-531-6006. And you can say to whoever answers the phone, I'm interested in volunteering, and then they'll take it from there.
And you can learn more about the organization at www.grassrootscrisis.org.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Andrea. I failed to mention earlier that Andrea is a long time Howard County resident. So, I mean, 1974, right?
That's right.
Yeah, well, you've seen a lot of changes here in your time.
And my children went to Howard County schools and graduated, and they're all doing well. Thank you.
Very good. Congratulations. Nice job.
Despite the fact that they weren't on the Newsweek list, right?
And then thanks for coming by today.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Councilperson Courtney Watson. As we alluded to earlier, she is front and center of the pool brouhaha.
Poolgate.
Poolgate. you're in deep water on this one. I can I bring up back the puns I said earlier?
No.
No.
All done. He's going to dive right in.
Yeah. Courtney.
Yes.
Here we are. You've had a public hearing.
Yes, we have.
You've had a legislative work session.
Yes.
And the feathers are flying all around the county over this pools issue. Where does it stand and where is it going?
Well, I am just back from a tour of one of our nonprofit swim clubs that I took with Calvin Ball, Mary Kay Siggety.
What do you do on a pool tour?
Jen Terraza.
Do you wear a bathing suit?
We went to Watermont Pool in Elkridge, where we were given a tour of the pool itself. We were shown the constraints about raising their member, the number of members. We were shown the equipment. We talked about what their challenges are.
Did any golf balls from Timbers come flying?
How they raise money? No, there's a lot of trees there.
Yeah, a lot of trees
in between.
Now, when you say you were shown the constraints of bringing on additional members,
right,
what does that mean?
Well, their parking lot, they're required by the size of their parking lot to have a certain number of members under their conditional use, so they can't exceed that based on their parking lot.
And they
can't expand their parking lot because they don't have any buildable land to expand into, so they are limited. That particular pool is limited, the number of members that can.
And they're maxed out right now for the number of people that can park there, so the problem is really the parking lot?
That's one of their challenges.
Got it.
That's interesting. So even if people can walk to the pool, it doesn't matter. Because that's in a residential neighborhood, correct?
Yes, but I mean that's not unusual. They are different in the sense that they have a conditional use, but the parking lots at all of our pools are sometimes overcrowded, as you know, if you've driven by any pool on a hot Saturday.
Because God forbid if somebody walked or had to get on their bike and ride to the pool, right?
I used to walk a mile to my pool.
There are walkers to Watermont, by the way. But where we are now is
was the parking lot crowded today?
Today it wasn't that crowded, and being a Friday.
Okay.
At noon, it wasn't that crowded. Their peak times are between 4 in the afternoon and closing,
okay,
and then all day Saturday and Sunday. So just to summarize, the bill was introduced because the state authorized local governments to enact a tax credit for nonprofit swim clubs. And the reason they did that was to try to equalize the playing field between nonprofit pools, which were built, most of them in the 50s and 60s, under the structure of a 501c7 membership nonprofit IRS regulations. That's how pools were built in the community then. In the 80s, pools became there were more pools built in Howard County under a new structure, the Homeowners Association structure. And when that happened, almost all pools were built under the HOA structure since the 80s. And there is an inequity between how the HOA pools are taxed and how the nonprofit swim clubs are taxed.
Okay.
HOA pools do not pay taxes. Right. The reason for that is that the state believes they make up potential tax dollars in the values of the homes.
The enhanced values of the homes that are part of the HOA.
Mm-hmm. Right. So.
And HOAs have a lot of other things, too. They could have tennis courts. They could have walking paths.
And in the early days, the nonprofit swim clubs weren't paying much in taxes. But as the value of the land that they sit on has increased, their taxes have increased. At Watermont, for example, their taxes have quadrupled in 10 years. Even though they appealed their tax assessment in 1998, they now pay about $10,000 in local taxes.
Okay. Well, you know, again, just trying to where it stands. So you introduced this legislation, and then immediately the Columbia Association or and several people in Columbia, there was a pushback saying, wait a minute, what about us? And what about them?
Well, the Columbia Association is treated
as an HOA.
No. The Columbia Association is taxed, but they're taxed at different land values than the nonprofit swim clubs, and then the HOAs, of course, aren't taxed at all.
Because Columbia is special.
Well, no, because Columbia has certain provisions that were put in place years ago, and a lot of their land is not buildable because they've designated it as open space.
Right. There's no reversionary value.
There are legitimate reasons why their tax burden is lower than the other pools.
I mean, theoretically, if Watermont went bankrupt and they had to sell that property, they could sell it for a market price.
Right.
If a CA closes a pool, they can't do it. It's open space.
They can do certain things on it, but they can't build houses.
Right. So it has limited market value.
So there is an inequity between how CA pays taxes and HOAs don't. And that's something that I think I will be exploring with the state delegation, in the sense of why is the Columbia Association taxed the way they are when HOAs who provide similar amenities are not taxed. Because the value of the homes in Columbia certainly is increased by the fact that they have 23 outdoor pools.
True.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but how's that different from a community that doesn't have its own pool but happens to be adjacent to a nice swim club? Is that really any different than a pool being within an HOA?
I don't necessarily think so. And I think we have realtors who would dispute the fact that a community's housing prices are higher because there's a community pool. So it's an assumption the state makes.
In fact, if we go under the assumption that many pools in Howard County are aged, need capital improvements, you can actually make the argument that they deplete the value of homes within an HOA. Not necessarily.
Eventually.
Right, exactly.
If they're not improved or maintained.
Because there's going to be a capital call for all the members of the Homeowners Association, and all of a sudden everyone's going to be stroking $5,000 checks because the concrete in the pool is crumbling.
Even worse, you know, suppose somebody drowns. Then you have a lawsuit, and that also adds cost to the HOA to defend themselves.
The way that the state assesses swimming pools is really what we're examining, and how we can, if appropriate, help nonprofit pools. And the reason we may want to help nonprofit pools is because Howard County has not done, I would say, a good job of providing an aquatic program in the county, mostly because they haven't had to, because we had the original Howard County pools and then we had Columbia Association that stepped in. Other counties have 12 or 14 public swimming pools provided by the county government.
But what do you say to those people, that Columbia Association, the number is always turned around, they have 23 pools, which they will acknowledge that a good number of them are far underutilized. So,
and Howard County is a small community, so even Ellicott City, Elkridge, Western Ellicott City residents, they can pay $600 and be a member of a pool within the Columbia Association.
It's not that far away.
No, it's not.
Well,
it's not in their backyard, but
the original six Howard County pools were built before the Columbia Association pools, so they existed before. And most people, even in Columbia, they go to their neighborhood pool. They either walk or they drive to their neighborhood pool. They don't necessarily drive to Ellicott City because there's a pool there. So the existing pools are there. They provide recreation for our citizens. They provide swim team. They provide jobs. They hire pool management companies based in Howard County. So they're in a way, they do much for the entire environment, not just the members of the pool.
You know, Dennis and Courtney asked me not to go there, and we were going to keep this brief, and I'm really trying, which is why I'm being so uncharacteristically quiet.
You are. You're.
All right. So, Watermont.
There's blood coming off your lip from
biting. No, it's not. So, you know, so Watermont, I guess the spokesperson, Conrad Katulski, had testified in front of you guys earlier this week, and their dues right now are $475.
Yes.
He's concerned that if they raise the dues, they're going to lose members.
Right.
Isn't this a basic supply and demand? If the people want the pool or don't want to have to drive to Columbia because, like you said, it's in their backyard, won't they pay that extra $125?
If they can, they will. But what their data shows is that their normal attrition.
Wait a minute. Their data. They surveyed members whether they would like a dues increase. But what do they expect to get? Yes, we'd like a dues increase.
No, but they've increased
dues. My taxes
dues.
To go up, too.
Right.
They've increased dues in the past. And when they increase dues, they have a higher attrition than when they don't. So in a given year, they might lose 15 to 20 families, and they try to bring those in through new memberships. When they've increased dues in the past, even if it's $25 or $50, they lose many more members.
Is that anecdotal, or is that that actually documented?
They told us that today.
Yeah.
Okay, and we had three of the members of the board of directors there. But it's not hard to believe that they would have more attrition when they raise their dues. They're concerned about people who have had to drop out because of the revenue and the economy. A lot of people can't afford a pool membership for different reasons.
But we're all suffering in different ways because of the economy.
We
so
are.
Why have we picked swimming pools as the topic du jour? Why is it that somebody, if they can no longer afford to be a member of the pool because the dues went up, maybe they need to move to Catonsville. Maybe they need to move to Arbutus.
There was a bill passed in Howard County 5 years ago by Ken Ullman and Guy Gazzone and David Rakes and whoever else was on the council at that time that provided the same kind of tax credit to
Covenant Field.
To the Soccer Association of Columbia. It was 100% tax credit based on the same state-enabling section
but
of the law.
But you could also make the argument that was a different time now.
You could make that argument, but there was no sunset in there. There were no other provisions in there. The purpose of that bill was to provide an incentive for more recreation space and to allow them to operate without paying taxes because they felt they were contributing towards recreation, which is something county government supports.
My concern, and I know this is a whole show and a whole different topic, but it's a slippery slope because if we say we could say with everything in life, you know what, 5 years ago they did this for this organization or for this kind of recreation, and therefore we now need to do it for this group or this organization.
Well,
and you know what, maybe my form of recreation is traveling instead of taking my kids to the pool. I can't travel right now the way that I used to travel maybe 4 or 5 years ago because the economy isn't what it once was. I'm injured by that, but I'm not getting a tax break to take my family on a trip.
I think that your view is sort of a separate issue. It may be the way you look at what government should and should not provide.
Myopic, maybe.
Many Howard County city citizens believe that we should be providing recreational opportunities for the public. And clearly, we have done that less than other counties in terms of the aquatic program.
So we're not going to be on like a top 10 list of aquatic programs?
No. But, you know, this is something that the state made available that other jurisdictions have enacted. Rockville has done it. Montgomery County has 55 swimming pools.
Only Montgomery County has adopted this so far, correct?
And the city of Rockville for the taxes,
right.
The city of Rockville. I don't know. I'm not sure. I think there may be some other jurisdictions, but those are the ones we know of. So it is one tool that we are considering. We, in terms of where the bill is going, I anticipate that...
That's where I was going to be. Where are we?
I anticipate that we will table the bill on Monday because we have learned some new information today that tells us we need to check into some of the HOA pools that are charging for memberships that we were told could not, and see whether or not they're taxed. So we really have to look at two issues. One is equity and one is need. And where the council members fall on how important those two issues are to the bill will determine what we do. It could be that we pass a tax credit in some form at the end of July. It could be that we develop some other way of assistance. It could be that we decide as a group they shouldn't receive assistance.
Right.
That's where we are.
Okay. Well, you know, Courtney, I know it was last minute. I know we pulled you away from your Watermont pool tour.
Yes.
But thanks for joining us because, you know, it is current, and the council is about to go on your summer break. So.
Yes. Well, we only have a month, but we start at the end of July, and we come back after Labor Day.
So you don't have as much as Congress does.
No.
I saw on the news last night.
Obama's bringing it back.
I saw on the news last night there have been 170 business days this year. Congress has been in session for 76 days.
It's a great job.
Great place to stop.
Thanks, Courtney.
You're welcome.
That about wraps up yet another episode of And Then There's That. Together with my co-host, Paul Scalney, we'd like to thank our producer, Dave Bittner, for making us look good on the internet, and to General Growth Properties and the Mall in Columbia for hosting our show again today. We'll be back again on July 15th with a show focusing on some of the major issues facing the Howard County School Board this summer. Among other things, the board is dealing with the removal of a board member and the search for a new superintendent. We are planning to have a school board member join us, and we'll announce who that will be on our Facebook page as soon as we have confirmation. We hope you'll visit us on Facebook and join us again in 2 weeks.